You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Yes, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you've reached us here at Answers for the Family. Today, I have as my co-host, once again, I have Rob Spencer.
Good morning.
Rob's a field manager of West Shield Adolescent Services, and he's the guy that's out there hands-on with the kids. We also have with us today, Doc Dan joins us from Redcliffe Ascent. He is the clinical director, and he's here to explore the success of Redcliffe's Adolescent Comprehensive Therapeutic Wilderness Program that has helped thousands of students and their families. We also have with us today, Steve Schultz.
Good morning.
Steve is the marketing director of the Redcliffe programs. He's been with us before, and we're glad to have him back. Hey, Doc?
Yeah.
Tell us.
And I do have to say, I really like your lead-in music. That was good.
Thank you. I composed it myself.
I thought so. Yeah, that was you on the drums too, right?
Yeah. No, actually, that was Rob on the drums.
That's Rob on the drums. Good.
Yeah. All right. You know, one of the things that I want to get into, and I had a chance to look at a little bit of the information, and one of the things that caught me was the term developmental vacation. Simply put, what is developmental vacation?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's one of the hallmarks of our program at Redcliffe. Our therapeutic protocol is pretty much based around the notion that the problem that we are actually treating with these adolescents that show up in our program is not necessarily that traditional diagnosis that tends to get stamped on their forehead. But the problem is actually that these are individuals, these are kids that are frozen at a much more primitive, a much younger state of developmental maturity than they should be, where they are in their mid-adolescence. So in essence, what's happening is these are kids who are trying to manage the world and cope with the world in a way that would be much more appropriate for a much younger child. Mm-hmm. And their understanding of the world and their ability to manage the world and move themselves around in this world, they're doing it the same way that a 4, 5, 6-year-old kid would do it. And the difficulty is that they've been on this developmental vacation for maybe up to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the real treatment task then becomes disrupting whatever this underlying dynamic has been that has sanctioned that developmental vacation for as long as it's been there.
Wow. Now, is this something that works for someone that's in their mid-30s?
Well, yeah. It knows no age limits. I mean, developmental vacation is a friend to all. Yes.
I'm on vacation right now, I think.
That's right.
Permanent vacation.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us if our son and daughter is on developmental vacation. As a parent, how are we going to know that?
Well, you know, and that's one of the things that we like to educate parents. There's a strong parent component that goes along with this, because as we view this, the parents send their children to receive treatment. Okay, they're not sending them to Redcliffe so that they can have some kind of a groovy alternative recreational experience. Mm-hmm. So they can come and hang around with these great wilderness people and get grounded, mm-hmm, and find that level of spirituality that comes from being in the wilderness. No, that's not what they're there for. They're actually there for treatment. So the adolescent is there for treatment, but for the parents, it becomes an opportunity for them to assess their child and assess their developmental maturity, and it gives them an opportunity to do so in an atmosphere where there are no other impingements that would infringe on their ability to assess what's going on. So there's a couple of things. We teach the parents right away just some very basic understandings of the developmental task of childhood and adolescence, and give them an opportunity to be able to assess their child according to these developmental tasks and using their own relationship with their child as a way of assessing these specific markers as well.
Okay, what are the basic tasks?
Well, we divide it up, and obviously, you know, as a child growing up, there's a number of physical developmental tasks that have to take place, but we're talking about a psychological mm-hmm. developmental task. And the best way to understand this, or at least the way, sorry about that, I'm just okay. you know, pounding the table here. I'm emphasizing the point, right? This is a
you're
this
very
one
dramatic.
Of those,
that's right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm having a hard time just sitting in the chair. I need to stand up. And
maybe you need a vacation.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. No, as we help the parents with this, and to some degree as well, when the children, when the adolescents are at a spot where they can understand this, one of the ways that we like to describe that to them is say, look, the easiest way is to get this is just to imagine yourself being the star of your own fairy tale, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. you got to insert yourself in this fairy tale. Here you are, the dashing young prince or this beautiful young princess who is residing in this amazing kingdom that is reigned over by your king and queen, who are your parents, okay? Mm-hmm. And every parent is going to be unique. Every kingdom is going to be unique. You have your parents as part of your kingdom. Now, one of the things that kids don't really like to hear immediately with all this, and this is part of the work that we have the parents do that is interactive with the kids while they're with us in the wilderness, is we have them write narratives. And one of the first narratives that we have them write is a narrative where they start talking about what this kingdom consists of and how it was right when that child was born. And we talk about the kinds of aspirations and goals that they would have originally had for that child. And kids have a hard time hearing this because they don't want to hear that the parents actually wanted them at some point in their lives to be able to take over the kingdom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they tend to have this view of parents, and as they're coming in this very developmentally immature spot, they have this view of these parents as not as this benevolent king and queen, somebody that really wants the best for me, but they have this view of them as being these ogres to some degree who are trying to take away their identity and stifle their creativity mm-hmm. and keep them down. You know, they're just trying to tell them what to do, or they're trying to mold them into little robots, you know, those kinds of things, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's really starting out with that basic concept. Look, your parents brought you into this world because they wanted you to take over the kingdom. They wanted you to be the person that at some point has your own kingdom, okay? And that's why you're living this kingdom now. Now, like in true fairy tale fashion, you got some tasks that have to be accomplished before you can take over your own kingdom. The first of those is this task of childhood, mm-hmm. right? Now, when I'm talking to adolescents, I don't tell them this, but when I talk to parents, I say, look, there really is no way. There's not any possible way for me to overemphasize the importance of this task of childhood, because if you don't resolve it, then it has lasting consequences. It really does. And it's not something that's more easily resolved later on down the road.
Right.
So that initial task of childhood, and it sounds kind of odd when we just throw it out there, but, you know, as we talk about it, I think you can understand where I'm right. going with this. And that first task of childhood is that child needs to come to a spot in their life, a position in their life, and this usually happens at about age 13 or 14, mm-hmm. okay, where they come to the conclusion and acceptance that everything that their parents have done has actually been in their best interest. Okay, they have to get to that place. And really, it's boiling down to this notion that they have to get to this idea that there is such a thing as benevolent structure in the world.
What, okay? But you're saying at 13 and 14, that's usually the time in which they believe anything but.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Anything but.
Yeah, there's no question. And there's no question that that's the case. And you got to realize that it takes them 10 years. It starts at about age 3. Because it really doesn't start happening until their language is developed and they have the cognitive capacity to begin thinking about these kinds of things. But you think about a 3-year-old, okay? A 3-year-old is that individual who still considers themselves to be the center of the universe. You know, that notion. And why would they not? You know, if they're still alive, living, breathing, and existing on this planet at age 3, it means that they have had to be the center of somebody's universe. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. And it's all right, because they're going to expect that at this point that they are in control, and that the rest of the world is there to serve them, and it's just going to perpetually be the same case forever and ever and ever. But Now they have this task where they what was that? There, I don't think there was a
no. I was just smiling. I'm going. You mean it's not?
Yeah.
You mean it doesn't stay that way?
Yeah, maybe for you, Alan. But geez, you know, does this look like a guy that's had perpetual people waiting on me for the rest of my life? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, what I say, I know that we've got a soundbite that is the task of childhood. Do you want to set that one up?
Well, it's probably close to what I just told you. I don't know, but if we could listen to it and see what it says.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go.
The way that I like to talk to them about this is I would say to them, well, look, John, it's really easy to understand. All you have to do is just imagine yourself being the participant in this fairy tale, right? You are the dashing young prince or the beautiful young princess, whichever the case may be, living in this absolutely gorgeous kingdom, okay, that is presided over by the goodly king and queen who are your father and mother. Now, the underlying assumption is, of course, at some point in your life, you are going to take over the kingdom, okay? That's the given in all of this. But before this can happen, you have two specific tasks that must be accomplished. The first is a task of childhood, and the second is a task of adolescence. And you can't get to that second one until you finish up with the first one. You've got to resolve that first one. So let's talk about that first task, the first task of childhood. So your first task of childhood then, Johnny, is that you must discover for yourself, you must come to that firm understanding for yourself, that your mother and father have your best interest in everything that they do.
All right. Now take us in a little bit into the second task. Just at this point, I believe the second task then is what, the task of adolescence?
Right, right. And part of the key of that first task, though, is that in essence, our children spend from age 3 to about age 13 or 14, 10 years of their lives. They spend 10 years of their lives scrutinizing us as parents to determine whether or not we're competent enough to be their parents, right? And that's really what it is. And so not only do they have this scrutiny that's going on when we're setting structure for them, when we're telling them, no, we're not going to eat cookies right now, and they throw a screaming fit. Or just the just like putting your child in a car seat kind of thing. You know, it becomes this incredible competition.
Duct tape. Always worked.
Yeah, whatever you got to do, but it's, you know, when kids are like at age 3 and parents say no, I'm going to set some structure for you. This is what we're going to do. Well, a child, a 3-year-old, doesn't have the capacity at that point to be able to step away from that and say to themselves, "Gee, you know, this is my mom talking here." Okay, and my mom, I know that my mom loves me, and I know that my mom has a perspective far greater than my own, and that I know that my mom would never do anything to me or for me that wasn't in my best interest. So I'm going to go ahead and defer to mom on this one. Okay, and sometimes we attribute that capacity to 3-year-olds, but they don't really have the ability to do that yet.
Right, but what you're saying is, if I understand you right, is that as they get a little bit older, then you make it sound like they're sort of like we as parents are auditioning. You know, we're auditioning to see if we really can handle this role.
Well, absolutely. And as far as our kids are concerned, that is the case, right? Mm-hmm. Again, because they're coming from the perspective that they are the center of the universe, right? And that you know, parents are at best objects at that point that reaffirm their existence and validate them. And you know, it becomes particularly nasty if it continues along and past age 13, 14 in there where kids really do begin assuming that parents are nothing more than human ATMs.
Yeah.
That all they have to do, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Yeah, all they have to do is just put the right emotional combination in and the parents spit out the goods.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the point then is getting back, it's like 10 years of scrutiny, figuring out who are these people? Who really are these people in my life? And how can I be the center of the universe if I have somebody in my life that says no to me as the center of the universe? And if they say no and make it stick, then it throws me into the first of a long series of existential crises that I'm going to experience as a kid. Go, yeah.
Right, but now aren't they also sort of determining, you know, they're making a decision. Should I listen to them? Should I follow their structure? Should I accept their boundaries? I mean, is that kind of what they're going to?
Yeah, I got a question for you, too. Actually, sure. You can go ahead and answer that.
But yeah, then, go ahead and answer.
And then that's absolutely the case because, again, the scrutiny, it continues no matter what's going on. We never get a relief from that as parents, right, from 3 to 13, okay? That's ideally when that happens. And so not only am I trying to figure out who these people are as a little kid, you know, who are these people when they're setting structure for me, but who are these people when, you know, we're out in the backyard having a water balloon fight and we're giggling and laughing and we're, you know, joking around at the dinner table and we're actually having fun. And they're sitting with me, struggling with my homework with me at the dinner table and those kinds of things. And they're on the sidelines watching me play soccer. You know, those are those people.
Right.
So it's the full realm. So that at some point then, when finally I'm getting that little burst of brain development in my prefrontal cortex right there at about 13 or 14, I have the ability to arrive at the conclusion. I get it. Okay, I get it. My parents actually do love me. Okay, I get it. And the reason why they have established this relationship with me and the reason why they have provided the kinds of things that they have provided for me is because they love me and they have my best interest in mind. Not because I'm entitled to this and I am demanding that they do this for me, okay, and they have to comply with my demands. I'm going to punish them. I'm going to make their life hell otherwise, okay? No, they really do love me. And so it also means that since they love me, they have set this structure for me as well. And it's not because they're trying to take away my identity. That's not they're trying to squash the only identity that I have is the center of the universe. But in actuality, they're helping me gain more influence in the world. And that's what I want for myself because at age 13 and 14, I'm right there at that place. It's all about power control. How much influence can I have in the world now?
Exactly.
Okay, so
go ahead, Rob.
One, no wonder I hate kids. No, I'm just kidding. Two, is this happening more on a subconscious thing, a level, than it is conscious? Because it's very cynical. Like, it's a very cynical way to look at my 11-year-old. You know?
Well, and see, the thing about it is 11-year-olds really don't have that ability to step out of it and look at it that way. You know, this is kind of like an adultomorphic view that
but
we're putting back on this process.
But if this is a conscious way of thinking... My kids are like, it's my kid who is a relatively good kid, you know, all this other kind of stuff, no problems with him. Very, very manipulative and very cynical.
Sure.
His mind, if he's on a conscious level thinking, you know, I gotta figure out how to play these people so I could stay this center of the universe versus, you know, everything that he gives us physically. You know, like, you're going to have your moments when you tell him he can't eat that giant cupcake for dessert, and he freaks out, like you said, or stuff like that.
Right.
But in general, day to day, it's all about just loving each other and that kind of stuff.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah, and he has
You are like two jokes away from really sounding like George Carlin. Carlin, is that his last name? The guy
Carlin.
George Carlin?
Yeah.
How's
and
that?
I bet with a
how's
little
that?
Work, he could be really good at that drunk taxi driver from Taxi. What was his name? You got to work on that one probably.
Hey, you guys give me go. He's lived over and far out.
Yeah, see, he knows who Carlin is.
It could be worse, man.
Yeah.
It could be worse.
What's his name? Jim Ignatowski or something from Taxi?
Yes.
The drunk guy? No one knows that guy? Anyways, back to the answer of the original question, if you can remember.
Well, and absolutely, you know, you make a good point about your 11-year-old because as kids are growing up, they still have this task and they're struggling, well, you know, how do I have as much power and control and influence? You know, especially as I'm looking at that notion, am I ready to abandon the center of the universe yet? And if I do, especially as a little kid, if I abandon that, there's nothing to replace it. There is absolutely nothing. I'm stepping out into this black hole of the universe.
So is this a conscious way of thinking, or is it a subconscious way of thinking? That's just kind of the bad nature of mankind, you know? That kind of is all about selfishness.
Well, I don't know if it's all about selfishness, but it's all about how do I...
Because I'm going to hit him when I get home.
And he'll say, what? Well, I was talking to Doug Dan today, and he said that you are...
he said... You're getting beat, and then you're going to go to a doctor.
No, it's just that developmental process that we go through. You know?
But what do we as parents, what can we as parents do to help that transition so that we don't get to that point at 13 and 14 years old where we go from knowing everything to knowing nothing? I mean, the running thing, at least for...
I think I'm pretty good on that one.
Yeah, you're pretty good.
I'll still know everything.
You'll still know everything? I mean, when one of my sons was 5 years old,
mm-hmm.
We're out in the backyard, and he's asking me question after question after question, and I'm answering them, and he stops, and he goes, "Wow, Dad, you know everything, huh?" And I go, "As far as you know, yeah." But I turned to my wife. I said, "Get the video camera." So she went and got it, came back, and so he's sliding on a little slide, and I go, "So now, what were you saying again?" He goes, "Dad, you know everything, don't you?" And so she videotaped it. And afterwards, she goes, "Why did you want to get that on videotape?" I said, "Well, because when he's 15 and I know absolutely nothing, yeah. I want to play the tape for him and go, do you think it might be somewhere in the middle?"
Very good.
So how do we take that transition when 13 and 14 comes around and one or both parents start to lose gray matter? You know, we get dumber.
Well, and here's the thing, though. It's the onus really is on the parents during that early piece, because if we have something else going on in our life that actually takes precedence over our kids, or it makes it so that our kids can't get to that place in their life and make that critical judgment call, you know what? I really do believe my parents. I really do see them as these individuals who have my best interest in mind. Now, if they haven't had that experience with their parents, that's going to be really hard to fake. They're not going to come to that spot.
So do most parents create the monster that hits?
Right, well, around, I don't necessarily think so, that's really the case. And it's not just the parents either. I mean, the kid's going to come to this planet with a specific constitution. And that's why, parents are always saying, "Gee, I have like four kids, and all of them are doing well, except this one."
This one,
I can't see what was different. Well, it was different. You're a different child for you're a different parent
right.
for every one of your child. Your life circumstance is different for every one of your children. They're living in a little different environment, those kind of things. It's a combination of stuff.
Well, and that's absolutely something I believe in, is that there's a certain amount of wiring that's there.
Mm-hmm.
That's for that child, that's the way it's going to be. Now, we as parents, I think we have a much, much, much more of an opportunity to screw things up than we do to make things right.
Right, because it gets harder to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that there's a certain amount of wiring, and you can take parent A, who might treat all four kids the same way. If they're doing everything the right way, then the odds are, I think, everything is going to come out fairly well. But I think that if you have a parent that is not wired well themselves, I think it's much easier for them to screw them all up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because it's tough for that kid to get at a place where I can say, "Oh, yeah, they're in structure. Mm-hmm. My parents are doing this in my best interest,
right.
and they're not using me to validate them." Okay, mm-hmm. I haven't had that experience somehow as a kid.
I like that term, benevolent structure. So I like that.
Yeah.
I
like the vacation one. I'm going to try using that when I wake a kid up at 3 a.m. from now.
Yeah.
How are you going on?
Time to end the developmental vacation.
Your developmental vacation
is over.
We're going on vacation.
We're disrupting that developmental vacation that you've
right.
been on. That's what it is.
Yeah. So anyway, let's. I know we've got a soundbite that is the task of the adolescent. So I want to play that, and then if you can comment on that
sure.
as well.
Sure, yeah.
Okay,
let's do that.
All right, now, when I get to that place, I can now move into that task of adolescence, right? And this is where it gets really cool, because it's no longer about me scrutinizing my parents any longer. It's no longer about my parents proving themselves to me, okay, that they are worthy of being my parents, that they're competent enough to be my parents, that they're smart enough, that they love me enough to be my parents, okay? It's no longer about me challenging them and scrutinizing them, that they have to prove that to me. Now, it's about me proving my ability to my parents that I can manage the little piece of the kingdom that they are giving me to manage.
All right. Okay, now tell us a little bit about now this second stage. Now they've gotten through that 13 or 14
right.
stage.
Right.
Now we're in adolescence. Tell us about that task.
Sure. Well, obviously it would be a huge waste of time if I continued to spend the next X amount of years through the rest of my life scrutinizing my parents. You know, mm-hmm. that's like, okay, wait, I've already got that piece.
Right.
My parents are good enough. But
what about the ones that have determined that they're not good enough?
Oh, yeah. Then what are they going to do? They're still in that earlier phase. This is part of that developmental vacation where I spend the extent of my existence pretty much scrutinizing everyone else around me. And I am continuing to be dependent upon everything around me to make me okay. And so if I'm not okay, it's never my responsibility that that's the case. You know, as the center of the universe, the reason that I'm not okay is because someone else or something else is not falling into place the way that I am dictating that it should. Okay?
Okay. Now, would a statement from a teenager that goes something like this at about, say, 15, where they would get to the point of saying, you know, I now understand better why you felt the need to correct me or why you corrected certain things that I was doing. You know, I now get it. Is that the point in which, you know, you can now say, okay, you know, they've made that transition now?
Yeah, that would be a pretty healthy statement for mm-hmm. a 15 or 16-year-old.
Yeah.
Because now it allows them to enter into that spot where now they are developing a process of discipline within themselves. Mm-hmm. Where we recognize, look, I'm going to trust my parents. I'm going to trust my parents that they know what's best for me as well. Okay? And I may not always agree with them, but I'm going to trust them that they have a perspective and that they're not trying to harm me. But now what I need to do is demonstrate to my parents that they can responsibly hand me increasingly larger portions of the kingdom, you know, or greater access to the adult level world, right? That's mm-hmm. really what that is. And that they can responsibly do that, knowing that as they give me greater access, I'm not going to use it to self-destruct.
Okay. And I know a lot of what we end up dealing with are the kids that are spoiled. And to them, the idea of getting the keys to the kingdom mm-hmm. is, give me the keys to the car, give me this. In other words, not really wanting to do anything to get there.
Oh,
just,
absolutely.
Just from the standpoint of, you've spoiled me up to this point, why wouldn't I expect to get that handed to me? Again, an example of a girl that I transported was, on her 16th birthday, she had an absolute fit. She was the daughter of a doctor, and when we got the call, she was trashing his office. She
nice.
Was destroying
nice.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. When I got there with the female agent, mm-hmm. to be able to take her out of there. And I asked her, I said, what's the problem? And she pointed out the window, and there's a Mustang convertible with a bow on it. And I go, I'm missing something. What's the problem? Like that. And she goes, my 16th birthday, and they got me that. My brother that turned 16 last year got a BMW.
Hmm.
So, I mean, her sense of entitlement was through
there
the roof.
Go. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's not a child yet that's done scrutinizing her parents. See, it's still all your fault. That
good
I
point.
I am not feeling that validation that I should have as the center of the universe. And it becomes increasingly frustrated the older that the child gets, because it becomes increasingly more impossible for parents to validate them that way.
You know, we made mm-hmm. a shift kind of as generations go on that the kind of like the transition times that you're talking about are getting later in a kid's life.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, that's what it seems
right.
like to me.
Oh, where absolutely.
Like, we're 13 and 14. I guess you call it like the, a lot of people refer to the World War II generation as the last great American, you mm-hmm. know?
The greatest generation.
Yeah. People work hard. People 18, they're out, they're, you know, doing their thing. They come back, they take care of their junk, they raise their kids. But then from there, it seems like we made a shift to a little bit lazier, a little more complacent, a little more entitled, a little bit da 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 da. Anyways, each generation that goes by, that the it seems to me that the transition times that you're talking about from stage one to stage two seems to shift a
right.
little bit longer.
Right.
And is that Obviously, the amount of damage you could do when you get older is way more. Mm-hmm. But is that a big problem that you're kind of having with your kind of the kids that come to you and that kind of
stuff? Oh, absolutely. I see that. Just even in the period of time and like the 15 years that Redcliffe has been in existence. And you know, the nature of the children that we see in the program has shifted, and the nature of the parents that we see has shifted. There's an individual, Bill Plotkin, who is a great wilderness guy, and he has coined that term that the difficulty is that as a society we are stuck in our own patho-adolescence now, and so we have forgotten as a society. Really, the purpose behind childhood and adolescence, and realizing that this is a fairly crucial stage in our development as human beings, mm-hmm. but we don't know as parents, and so we're transferring our lack of knowledge and our lack of understanding onto our children as well.
I mean, is it that parents are just forgetting? I mean, because you know, from my standpoint, you know, I try to look at it and go, you know, I remember when. So, you know, I realize that they're going to go through certain things, you know, and I remember doing certain things that they might be doing and going, you know, I got through it okay. I realize that that's going to be part of their growth process. But are parents trying, or are they forgetting, so they're trying to stifle it? Or do they think that it was so bad before that they have to stifle it?
Well, I think the correct answer would be it depends,
yeah.
Really. and it's a unique situation for every family. But I also think that we have a society that is much more willing to hand over the influence of an adult-level world to children far sooner,
mm-hmm. you
know, far sooner than they're ready to handle it. And we hand it over to them, and they self-destruct. And that's what we've been trying to avoid.
And then they say, oh, they're just kids.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, will teens eventually outgrow this condition, or should parents try to wait it out?
Well, I, the way that I would look at it is, has my child actually made it to that place where they've gotten that notion that there is such a thing as benevolent structure, and they're just struggling a little bit to not wanting, to be a little resistant to wanting to do the kinds of things that they have to do to start demonstrating discipline? You know, are they getting themselves up and going to school, realizing, look, if I want to have that high school diploma, I got to go sit through class. Mm-hmm. I got to sit there and listen to the boring instructor that I don't really necessarily like and I don't think is going to be relevant, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to go home. I'm going to do my homework. You know, those kind of things. You know, are they someplace paying their dues? Are they wearing a paper hat someplace? You know, saying, would you like fries with that? You know, and having to deal with people that they don't really want to deal with, having to manage a boss, you know, those kind of things. It's the grunt work of adolescence. Okay. If they're doing that, but they're resisting that piece, then yeah, they're going to get it. You know, we're going to grow into it. We might need a little bit of time. But if we're still at a place where they're avoiding the grunt work completely, and their life task is still all about scrutinizing their parents and everybody else, the rest of society, to determine whether or not society is good enough. You know, that's those kind of things. Like, well, I'm not going to school because the teacher hates me, and all the kids there tease me, and the subject matter is irrelevant, or I got popped for possession because it's a stupid law anyway, and the cops had it in for me. You know, it's all of those kinds. If we're at that spot, then we're still way back there on a developmental vacation, and we're not going to grow out of that just naturally. There needs to be intervention at that point.
Hey Dan, what would your answer be to that young lady that Alan talked about who said she was discussing that Mustang convertible? I mean, how would you handle that if one of your daughters said, "Hey, I want to have a Mustang convertible." What would your answer be?
I'd say, "Yeah, I would. You know what? I would really love it for you to have that Mustang convertible." It really hasn't been that far off of the discussion that I've had with my own son, who just he turned 16 last October. You know, and he's been kind of priming me all along. It's like, well, hey, I'm going to be turning 16. What kind of wheels are you going to show up here? And, you know, it's that whole idea. And I'm sure that this girl's father would be in the same place. But it's this kind of thing. And obviously, I wouldn't be in the position to be able to provide either a brand new Mustang or a brand new BMW. But when my son, we had this little talk, and he said, well, so, you know, am I going to get a car? What's it going to be? And I told him, well, look, you know, nothing would please me more than on the morning of your 16th birthday, we went down to like the Nissan dealership. And, you know, we wouldn't be driving anything new off the lot. But if I would absolutely love it if we bought like a 2006 350Z that you were driving that thing off the lot. Because if you were driving a 350Z off the lot, on your 16th birthday, it means that the relationship that you and I have would be impeccable. Okay, if I was willing to co-sign on that for you, it means that I would trust you to the extent that I know that not only would you be able to manage a car like that and not put yourself or somebody else in danger as a result mm-hmm. of having that car, but that you would also be, I would have a history with you that would demonstrate to me that you could pay for that car, that you would be making the payments, that you would be making the insurance payments on that thing, you would keep gas and oil and the maintenance up on that thing, and at the same time, you would still be doing your academic work and athletics kind of things that you know that you're going to be doing, and I wouldn't have to question you. I would trust you fully. So I would love for you to have that car because it would mean that you and I have this relationship that is stellar, unquestionable. But let's look at our history mm-hmm. and see where we are with all of this. Now, you got to remember, I'm the parent that wanted you to have the 350Z, okay? Right. I want you to have that 350Z. But let's look at where our relationship is, okay? And as I review that, I'm thinking, you know what? You probably better go out there into the barn and take a look at your grandpa's van that that all your sisters drove when they were in high school. And, you know, if you want some wheels, you better start pimping that thing out because that's what you're going to be driving. And it's not because I don't want you to have the 350Z. It's just like I need you to get to a place where you can have that and I can responsibly give that to you.
Right. And I think it's also, I mean, it's responsibly give it, but not everybody can afford to go do that, and especially not in this economy. I think one of the things that it was done for me by my father, and now he's doing that for my son who's 15, and that is he went and he asked me first, but he went and got an old four-wheel drive truck that needs a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and he actually had me go pick it up, and he said, you know, we're going to bring that out to his house, you know, to my dad's house, and whenever we go over there, my son will be able to work on it. And he said that, you know, you're going to work on it. You're going to help make this the vehicle you want. If you want it to have bigger tires and you want it to have, you know, a different color, whatever you want, you're going to learn how to do all of these things to do it.
Right.
And provided that you have the relationship with your parents and you have the grades necessary, come 16, I hope that I can give this to you. So I think it's very similar to what you're saying.
And again, it's not about me not wanting this for you. Okay?
Right.
I really am the good enough parent, and I know mm-hmm. that I am. I don't need you to validate me as a good enough parent. But it's all about you. Are you willing to do the grunt work?
Right.
You know? And really, it's that whole idea. I want you to take over the kingdom. I want you to have more influence in this world than I do. But I can only responsibly give you access to that influence right now to the level that I can trust that you're not going to self-destruct with it.
Yeah, I like it. Now, having actually heard one of your seminars at one of the conferences, there was a term that you used, and I'd like you to share a little bit, and that was the term psychological basement. What is the psychological basement?
Sure, and you know that's a great one because we like to talk a lot about what children do to continue to manage their parents, and that tends to fall under the rubric of manipulation, you know? and children find out very quickly, you know, what it is that they have to do to be able to maintain this influence over their parents, and typically it's some sort of manipulation.
Okay, now we have a soundbite on that.
Oh,
do you want to go to the soundbite or?
Sure, let's do that. And then if we need to elaborate after that,
that would be great. Here we go.
When Johnny comes to Radcliffe and they start the process of finding out who they really are, of course, they are going to find out that they are much more capable, talented, disciplined, intelligent individual than they may have given themselves credit for. Nevertheless, there is an amalgamation of other stuff that is comprised of all of those things that we would just as soon not have in our life, just as soon not have as who we are as human beings. All of the things that we consider to be defective or damaged or painful or shameful, okay? All of those kinds of things. So instead of bringing them into our consciousness and allowing them to be a part of the persona that we have as human beings, what we do instead is we create what I guess could be termed like a psychological basement for ourselves, right? And there's this nice little closet down there in that basement, you know, and so we open that closet up and we throw all of that painful emotional material down there in that closet, and we slam the door and we put the chain lock on there, right? Then we run up the stairs and turn off the light, and we go about our lives as though that didn't exist, because we don't want to have to deal with it, and we certainly don't want anybody else to know about whatever that stuff is in the basement.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so essentially that the material that's down there in our basement is whatever that part of us that we've detached from, you know, that really is a reality of who we are, but for whatever reason, we have not personally developed the coping mechanisms to incorporate that into our full personality as human beings. And so it's that part that we want to detach and ignore and avoid, and it really is the piece of us that prevents us from saying yes to a full spectrum of life.
Okay. Do you see this? I mean, after just listening that, Rob, do you see this in some of the kids that we're picking up as far as this type of detachment?
In some of the kids?
Well, I mean, I know it's in all
of
them.
The kids.
Right.
Yeah, it's like I said, that's what made me bring up the point of the shift in generations, how it gets later and later, because kids, we're dealing with 15, 16, 17. They're all still in that childhood stage. It's amazing. It's amazing how no sense of responsibility for their actions at all. Mm-hmm. It's and the amount of damage they do, you know. So just about every kid, at some point, you identify same traits in them that as every other kid that we're dealing with, and it all has to do, I think, with that transition.
Well, Alan, I was as I'm listening to the conversation, I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's parents out there that are listening to this, and there's parents who have kids out there, and they're being faced with this developmental vacation, and there's that manipulation that's going on. You know, those kids that Rob's talking about that you get picked up at the home, and they may be cussing and swearing at their parents, or they may be, you know, they may not be happy with the Mustang convertible.
Right.
You know, and I'm curious about what manipulation is, because manipulation, we always think, oh, my child is manipulating me.
Right.
Right. And we think it's something that's being done to us. But Dan,
it's negative too, and it's not always
right.
A negative.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And with some of the parents, you know, it's, you know, and I want to say to them, first of all, it's not all about you. You know, when the parent goes, but they're doing this to me, and they're manipulating me, and they're doing this to me, and I'm thinking, and you're wondering why your child is focused on themselves. Listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
But anyway.
The whole dynamic of manipulation has much to do with whatever it is that's in our personal, that psychological basement that we were referring to. Mm-hmm. And more than anything else, our kids find out right away, because they've lived with us however many years that we've been alive, right? They've been alive. They find out that painful material that we're trying to avoid at all cost, whatever that might be in our basement. Now, they might not know how it actually got there or actually what it consists of, but they know how to get us to have to look at this dilemma of do I let this material out, or do I concede to doing whatever it is that they would like me to do? That's how manipulation is as effective as it is.
All right. And one of the things that I want to do, and I looked up at the clock and I realized time has flown by. We do have a couple of listener questions. Now, fortunately, because we had you listed on the mailings that went out over the last few weeks, people knew you were coming on, so we had a couple of listeners that sent in a couple of questions, and I want to always make sure that I address those before we run out of time. I have one from a listener who said, every time I set limits with my teen, he seems to behave worse. What can I do?
Absolutely. And that's one of those things, again, that's part of the parent education process.
Right.
One of the questions I ask the parents always is, how do you know if the intervention that you've selected is actually going to do the job? Is this potentially the right intervention? And again, for parents who are looking for long-term intervention or looking for some kind of a treatment program as well, you know, that kind of thing, it's that same question. How do I know that this is the right treatment? And typically what parents do is they'll give me answers like, well, my child will become more responsible, or that they will be more respectful towards me. I say, no, you're thinking too far ahead. Okay, a potential intervention, we know that it has the potential for having its intended effect if we see an immediate acceleration of whatever that negative behavior was. Okay, this is called an extinction burst, is what this is called. All right, and it's the equivalent of that 3-year-old throwing a fit on the floor when you tell them, "No, we're not going to eat cookies right now." And really, what it is, it's a part of that contest. It's a part of me ensuring that you can't say no to me and make it stick because I'm still in control. And so you say no to me, I'm going to increase this, I'm going to accelerate my behavior.
Exactly my thought. Yeah, that it just comes down to a power struggle, you know, of the child saying, you know, if you're going to take this stand, I'm going to push even harder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And with the intended purpose is that I want you to freak out about this as a parent.
Right.
Okay. I want you to say, oh my gosh, look what I've done. I've only made it worse. But the difficulty with this is, and it goes back to just kind of pure principles of learning and pure behavioral kinds of things, it's the idea is that if your child goes through that extinction burst, and as a parent, you freak out and say, oh, what have I done? And you remove whatever that intervention was. If you remove that structure, with the idea that, well, at least now the behavior will go back down to the level to which I was more familiar, that's where we get mistaken. Because what happens is if we intervene, set some structure, we accelerate that behavior, now we've just increased it to a new baseline. And the next time that we want to intervene, it's even going to have to increase it even farther. So, you know, for that listener, I hope that he or she is listening. It's like, look at that acceleration of that behavior as a signal that the intervention or that structure that you have imposed potentially now will do its effect, do the job that you intended to do. And the crucial piece of this is maintaining that structure,
right?
And not letting it fall.
Right, and that's what I was going to say is that you've got to stick to your guns, or it's only going to get worse. Because every time you reinforce the fact that you know, if I act out to this level, then I get what I want, they'll keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing
right.
it. So another question. It says, and again, this is again from a listener. It says, I'm considering sending my 15-year-old son to a wilderness program. A friend says that they're very controversial. How will I know my child will be safe? And then a second question, how do I know which one is best for my son?
Very good. And, you know, I think anyone, any parent that is considering taking such action like that would be a reflection of how I would want them to approach that. And, you know, one of the things, too, is I would make sure that they make that distinction between a therapeutic wilderness program and a boot camp, because they are not the same entity. And at this point right now, there's very few privately owned boot camps out there. So and they're not overseen by the same kinds of entities out there as well. But there are a number of wilderness programs out there. There are those that are therapeutically based, and then there are those that are more adventure-based. And depending upon your child's needs, this would be one of those places where it would be absolutely fantastic to enlist the service of an educational consultant that would help you be able to differentiate between which program your child needs, and also knowing that there are ed consultants out there who have actually face-to-face familiarity with individuals that work in those programs. They would be the ones that could guide you through that kind of tricky waters of selecting what's the most appropriate one, which one has been around the longest, which has the best safety protocols, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, exactly. And I couldn't agree more, and that's one of the things that I try to promote as well, is that if you talk to the ed consultants, many of them go out, they visit the programs, they know the little idiosyncrasies, the differences that each one of them provides. And I know that we're about to run out of time.
Got a quick question.
Yeah, throw out a quick question, but then before we end, Steve, I'm going to go to you because you haven't let the rest of us get a word in edgewise. Can you please tell people, if they have more questions, how they're going to be able to get in touch with you or to get to the websites? Rob,
okay, here's the realness of what's going on right now, at least in California. I would say less than 10% are educational consultants and families and all these people kind of involved, intending on doing the right thing with the therapeutic wilderness. And the bulk of it is parents that are either trying to, unfortunately, either trying to punish their kid, mm-hmm. or by trying to use that wilderness as a filler to find something for them. When you get, first of all, are most of your kids, do you find that in your place? And then what can you really do to help that kid anyways? Because once the kid's away from the parent,
okay,
and we still want to help
Dan,
the kid.
Dan, I'm going to ask you to answer that one off air if you can. No, only because we're running out of time. And Steve, can you please give us the contact?
The best way to contact us is through our website. It's www.redcliffascent.com.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We're out of time. And everybody, stay tuned. And shortly, you'll be hearing from Dory Francis. We're out of here.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks.
Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.